Les colloques du Collège de France.
It's time to resume, and we're very pleased to have Lisa Manning coming from Syracuse University to talk to us about some aspects of mechanics. So we're moving from genomics and signaling to the mechanical world. But don't forget about the first part, it's all integrated. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you. And thanks so much for the invitation. I'm very excited to be at this conference, mostly because I'm talking about something which is I haven't been working on for that long, and thinking about how information plays a role in the system is something that I'm still learning about. And I'm also talking about brand new stuff that's definitely not published and even has very large error bars, you'll see at the end, because we're still doing the simulation. So, but I think hopefully I will learn stuff from you all too here. Okay. And so before I get started, I want to highlight the people who did the work. There's a lot of people who've contributed to ideas, but I want to especially highlight Sajjad Arsash, who's a fantastic postdoctoral associate that's been working with Andrea Liu and I, and just recently moved to Georgia Tech for a postdoc. And of course, almost all of what I'm talking about today is in collaboration with Andrea Liu. And another fantastic postdoc with her, Indrajit Ta. Okay, so I used the word learning in my title, and that might have been a mistake, because when you talk about learning, especially to a group of people who, like the folks who work in neuroscience and have thought very much about learning, there's a lot of questions about what you mean by that word. And so what I'll say is that I actually don't care too much today about the distinction between learning versus adaptation versus optimization. I think of it as a continuum where, you know, on this side of learning, you think about things that can generalize, that learn features, that predicts and classifies, and maybe even has an internal representation. Adaptation is responsive on some time scale to external stimuli, and maybe optimization is way over here where it's just something that executes a pre-programmed task. And so the reason that I want to think about these set of ideas in development is because developmental process, often we think about development executing a program that's sort of been determined by evolution ultimately, about how things sort of just follow a pre-program. But there's a lot of, you know, very old and beautiful work suggesting that developmental processes can be highly adaptive and robust to perturbations, and they can be robust over developmental timescale. So this is this lovely experiment where you cut something in half and you basically get blastulas that are just the same, holes of half the size. And so incredibly robust to a gigantic perturbation in this case for the frog. And then some work by Thomas Greger and others that have shown that if I can also have things that are robust over evolutionary time scales, that I can look at gradients in the different types of eggs, of insects, flies, and that there's a characteristic gradient that's maintained. And I think now we know that this is a little bit oversimplified description of the theory, but nevertheless, the idea is that if you want to specify the length of an egg, you can change the length of the gradient, right? And it does that very robustly, apparently over evolutionary timescales too. Okay, so there's been many examples of this type of robustness, and I would argue that the way that folks often explain this robustness in careful experiments and theory is a set of feedback rules between biochemical and mechanical degrees of freedom. And so the question that I'm exploring today is whether we could frame some of these ideas that have already been in the literature in a framework where we say maybe there are local rules that are acting on tunable degrees of freedom coupled to physical degrees of freedom to generate adaptive behavior, and that this would be a general and maybe powerful way of thinking about what to do next if we frame it this way. And why it's powerful to frame it this way, even though this says almost the same thing, I think, is because there's been a lot of progress made in AI, and in particular in layered neural networks, where we understand a lot now about how machine learning works in those neural networks. And the idea, I mean, I'm sure you all know this already, but just to remind you, and it's actually very reminiscent of what Yaron already said, is that, you know, how does a neural network generally work? This is a cartoon, but the idea is you have some input, like a picture of a cat or a dog. You have a lot of layers. I'm showing you one layer, but a lot of hidden layers of networks. And the key thing is that there's all of these weights between the different objects that are tunable degrees of freedom when you're training the system. And then they all project onto some output. And the idea is you want to adjust the internal tunable weights or the adaptive degrees of freedom in this network in order to make it robustly classify an output cat or dog. And the way that you do the training is you have a cost function, which is the actual output of the system with a given set of weights, minus the predicted output for that set of inputs. And you want to minimize, by changing these weights, these tunable degrees of freedom, you want to minimize that cost. Okay. And you know, there's these lovely algorithms like backpropagation that let you do it very computationally efficiently. All right. So recently, in the past, I would say maybe 5 years, a bunch of physicists, materials scientists, engineers have had the idea that you can actually do this in physical systems. So the idea is that in physical systems, you also have adaptive degrees of freedom. And I think the easiest one to see is this resistor network. In a resistor network, if you have variable resistors, you can tune the resistance in your variable resistor network, and that's an internal degree of freedom. And the physical degrees of freedom have to do with the currents running through this network, right? So there's a separation into these tunable degrees of freedom that you have individual control over, like weights in a neural network, and physical degrees of freedom, and the two are coupled. And so there's some other examples. This is one of, you know, basically doing image recognition using a vibrating plate, and you can also design systems that have, by design the geometry of systems to have it execute a task. And so this, I would say, is a lower level optimization learning task, and this is a higher level training generalization type of problem. Okay, and so here's some different tasks that they can do. Digit recognition, which is hard. Image classification is hard. Maybe low loss signal transition, that's an easier task potentially. Okay, so then the question is of course, I have done a lot of thinking about the mechanics of biological tissues, especially in development. And so when you think about all of those physical systems that are doing computation through the mechanics of individual tunable degrees of freedom, it's very natural to ask, well, of course, all the ingredients for that sort of computation exist in a developing tissue. And so you might wonder, is this tissue doing some computation to help achieve tasks that an embryo would like to do physically in situ instead of having to go through an external processor or use things like DNA expression? Okay, and so if you wanted to try to formulate what that might look like, a cost function might be something like the actual state of the tissue minus the desired state of the tissue. So for example, a tissue that's square to a tissue that has aspect ratio 2. Adaptable degrees of freedom at this level of coarse graining. So we saw another example from Yaron where we might have tunable degrees of freedom in, you know, heterodimerization of molecules. But here, you know, at this scale of modeling, it might be something like tensions on interfaces or signaling molecule concentrations that lead to cell fate decisions. Something like that might be the degrees of freedom here. And you want then to try to minimize the cost. And you have the idea that if this thing is doing this internally, you might want to do it via local learning rules on these adaptive degrees of freedom. In other words, you don't want to do a global gradient descent, but you want the system to compute that gradient using local information, potentially. Okay? And the key thing is in physical systems, so there's one set of things where you minimize these adaptive degrees of function, of degrees of freedom with respect to a cost function, which is just a desired task. But then this is a physical system, so it also must minimize its mechanical energy with respect to the physical degrees of freedom. And so there's sort of this dual optimization idea. And that shows up also in this set of problems. So in these sets of problems, they also have to do both of those two minimizations simultaneously. Okay, and so one of the questions that we think is interesting and not well understood, I think, for lots of these physical systems, is which tunable degrees of freedom are useful for which tasks. Because you might say, if I have a given set of degrees of freedom, is that sufficient complexity to execute a task that I want a tissue to do? And does it, is it possible? Okay, and so the inspiration for this question came from some work spearheaded by Varda Haig, and they're at Illinois now, faculty at Illinois. And the idea is that we were looking at jammed packings, mechanics of jammed packings of particles. And so if you want to make an exotic state for a jammed packing of particles, what you can do is you can say, I have these physical degrees of freedom, which are the centers of each one of those particles. But then I could view the radii as being a tunable degree of freedom. Like maybe if each radii could be controlled, then that's a tunable degree of freedom. And then I need to tell you what the cost function is, the task that I want these particles to do. And so in many cases, the simplest cost function, although it seems kind of redundant, is the mechanical energy itself. Because if you make the cost function the mechanical energy itself, it finds low energy states. And that can be interesting. It was interesting for us for this problem. It makes the, it's sort of a way of making the system stay floppy for a longer time or fluidized for a longer time. Okay, and so what we decided to do then is that you say, okay, of course you could fluidize this system in kind of a dumb way if you made all of the radii smaller at the same time. That would be a very easy way. But a hard optimization problem or interesting one would be keep the distribution of the radii fixed. So this picture and this picture have the same exact distribution of radii, and I'm showing you the color is the radius of each particle. But this one has undergone this exact type of optimization on the tunable degrees of freedom, the radii. So on a computer, you can actually just find the global minimum of changing the radii to minimize the energy. And when you do, you generically find this type of state as opposed to this unoptimized state. Okay, and so if you added these radii degrees of freedom, what actually happens is you actually shift the number of contacts in the system, and this is 3D data, from 6 to 8. And you're tuning the spatial correlations between the radii, and it allows you to find these exotic states. Okay, and it explains some things that in the glass physics community people were interested in. But the point that I want to make for this talk is actually, we also tried tuning the stiffnesses of the particles, because that's another degree of freedom you could potentially tune, and it doesn't do anything. I mean, it does something very minimal. So it doesn't work to really perform a dramatic change in the material properties of the tissue in this case. And so I think this sort of, and in this explicit example, we were able to determine why that is. There's a math proof for this exact example as to why that is. It's because this degree of freedom doesn't really overlap with the changes to the contact network that you need to achieve this fluidization. Okay. And so one question that we wanted to ask is, could there be something similar to this occurring in development? My group and others have worked on these 2D vertex models for confluent tissues. I'll very briefly say what this model is. It's for confluent epithelial tissues where you, it's most easy to explain in monolayers, where you have a layer of cells, and if you look at a bird's eye view of that layer of cells, each cell has a cross-sectional area A and a cross-sectional perimeter P. And then if you say that cells have a homeostatic, you know, surface area or perimeter that they like to maintain, you would encode that in a P naught. And if you say they maintain a homeostatic, well, volume, and then you say height fluctuations are small, that gives you a characteristic cross-sectional area that cells maintain. And then this is the stupidest energy functional you can write down that takes you back to those homeostatic states. And so that's what you write down. One of the things that surprised us when we first started looking at this is that in disordered systems, there is a characteristic value of the dimensionless ratio between this in this. So this is just the shape. So if I have cells that have a small perimeter relative to their area, then they're more rounded. And if they have a larger perimeter relative to their area, they're more floppy. And the interesting thing about this system is it undergoes a rigidity transition in disordered systems at a characteristic value of this shape parameter. And on one side, it's fluid. And on the other side, it's solid. Okay. And so the question, you know, and I don't want to talk about this here because this is a whole different set of talks. But I think that our group and others over the past 10 years or so have wondered why this rigidity transition happens, right? We figured this out in this disordered system in 2015, and actually this paper by Frank Hulicker and collaborators showed that it happened in an ordered system even before that. So figuring out why systems become rigid is non-trivial. In jammed systems, they become rigid, so the particle packing becomes rigid basically when the number of degrees of freedom equals the number of constraints. And so in the physical learning in spheres I just showed you, it turned out that changing the radii allowed you to change the number of relevant degrees of freedom, and so then you got some more constraints that were allowed, and that's why the rigidity changed. But we've shown in a bunch of stuff, and others have shown, that vertex models and fiber network models become rigid in a different way from sphere jamming via a second order rigidity transition. And again, I'm not going to talk about the details today, but it's really different. And I have a review article that tries to describe really the differences between these two types of rigidity transitions. But the point for this talk is that given that the mechanism for rigidity is really different in these two types of systems, it's not clear whether physical learning will work at all to fluidize these vertex models, whether something similar happens in this whole different class of systems. So we wanted to ask, you know, can we enhance the fluidity of a tissue? And that's not just kind of a mathematical question. Fluid-solid transitions have been shown to be important in lots of developmental processes. So we want to understand how cells might control those generically. And we have the tunable degrees of freedom in these types of models, or just the individual vertex model parameters. So what that looks like now is this was the same energy functional, except now I have these tunable parameters that can be different for every cell. The stiffnesses of these moduli and then these shape parameters basically can be different for every cell. Okay, and we want to know what happens. We're trying to fluidize the system, so we want to know if we can shift this transition point by doing physical learning in this system, essentially. Okay, and I'm not going to walk you through any of the details of the slide. The first point is, just like how I said, if you changed all of the radii in one of those particle packings, you shrunk all the radii, of course you could make it floppy. The same thing is true in vertex models. If you change the average value of the shapes, you could make it fluidized. And so we're going to just do the same thing we did in the particle system, where we're going to ask if we have the same distribution of cell shapes. So now I'm coloring cells by their cell shape, which is the order thing for this particular system. Can I get different fluidity just by doing physical learning on this system? Okay. And the first thing we looked at were these stiffnesses. And so when we add those as degree of freedom and basically try to optimize the system to minimize the energy and fluidize the system, basically it doesn't do very much at all. These curves are almost right on top of each other. But if I change either the shape degrees of freedom, or it turns out also these area degrees of freedom, then I can change the transition point dramatically. There's a big shift in where this thing becomes fluid. And so, you know, we can ask, okay, what's going on? What's the mechanism that's generating this behavior? And so the idea is, so here's this snapshot is from a system that has exactly the same set of cell shapes. They're just organized differently. And this one is floppy and this one is rigid. So what did the optimization do? It basically changed the distribution of the tensions in the system. It turns out that this, once you do this optimization, you can generate a non-percolating set of tensions in this network, and that's what allows the system to fluidize. Okay, and so the key point for this part, this is sort of a vignette, because before we went and tried to do something that was actually happening in a developmental system, we wanted to know if we could do learning at all on tasks like these mechanical tasks. And the answer is, Yes, you can do learning on the mechanics in a second order rigid system like a vertex model, but again, not using all of the degrees of freedom, and we learned which one was important for this task. It was the shape, which essentially controls the tensions. And if you can't zero out a tension, then you're in trouble, basically, or make it very small. Okay, and maybe I just highlight for folks in the audience, I think this is a very exciting open question, and it's in talking to folks in neuroscience too, I think it's open there, is, you know, in these two cases, we also have an explicit proof in the vertex model of why this works. But more generally, if you looked at a task and you looked at tunable degrees of freedom, is there a more general theory of which ones control which tasks and which ones don't? And I think that's open. Okay. So then the next thing I want to talk about is what else can a tissue do? That was sort of a boring task, in some sense, fluidizing a tissue. And what else can the tissue learn to do by tuning tensions? Because we sort of learned that tensions were the important thing to control. And so the next thing I'll show you is looking at convergent extension. But the way we'll set up the problem is that actually it's what we're using doesn't have to be applied just to convergent extension. Any specified pattern of strain in a tissue could be generated using the same technology. So let's say I wanted, you know, a flow that was divergent here and convergent here and some shear strains. Like any set of strains can be specified. But right now we're doing convergent extension. And from the last project, we say, okay, let's think about tuning the individual tensions on each edge in one of these systems. So here's a picture of tissue flow in the Drosophila embryo. You see there's these large flows and invaginations. And in particular, we're going to look at this one particular part where the tissue goes from being about, you know, aspect ratio 1 to sort of folding up and being about aspect ratio 2 inside this egg over a particular, you know, time period in the development of the tissue. We're interested in that. So the task then is to just change the aspect ratio of a tissue by a factor of 2. Okay, and then again, this is a vertex model, and we've simplified it even further to, you can also do this for the full vertex model, but you can even do this, you can do it here where you just put tensions on each of the edges. And then now we say, okay, my cost function is the target is I want something that's changed its aspect ratio, and here's the aspect ratio of the tissue. And the key idea is that if these are the tunable degrees of freedom, then very simply all I want to compute is the derivatives of this cost function with respect to these tensions, and I go downhill on the global gradient of that cost function. Okay, and if I have this, you know, model set up on a computer, then I can literally just do it on the computer. I can compute those gradients because I have access to all the information in the tissue, and I can figure out what's the best, and so what we're doing really is computing what's the optimal way to change each individual tension on each one of these interfaces in the tissue to make it do this task. And that's unique. There's like one answer, okay? And you can compute that answer. And here's what it looks like. So this is the answer on a computer of what happens if you're trying to figure out. And so the colors are showing you the tensions on the interface. And this is showing you how much strain I'm getting over simulation time. Okay, so the first thing is it does very nicely do convergent extension. And you get some pattern of tensions in here that happens in sort of a black box, just like it is with AI, okay, to some extent. Okay. But of course, you know, in the Drosophila embryo, the embryo cannot have it doesn't have an external processor that, you know, computes these gradients for the global gradient descent. And so one of the things you can ask is, well, there's been observations of how those tensions are polarized, many, many beautiful work by lots of different people on how those tensions are polarized during this developmental process. And so this is the intensity of myosin as a function of like the orientation of the edge. And what people have found experimentally is basically data that looks something like this, which is basically that the tensions are look like cosine of 2 theta, basically. They are well fit to a function. So that means you get a lot more tension on vertically oriented interfaces with a function like that. And so if you take a system, and this is a rule that just depends on you knowing what your orientation is with respect to vertical. And so that's still a question of how cells know that piece of information, but it is local. It's just a piece of information about you relative to some global data point. And so if you use this as a local rule, that just the tensons are changing in order to generate this distribution locally with local information, you get a different pattern. So this is the pattern you get. It also does convergent extension. It does convergent extension very well, and it didn't do a global computation at all, right? This is a local computation. Okay. Another thing you can do is you can say, okay, if I was trying to figure out what the best local rule that approximates the global gradient would be, that would be a good thing to try to compute, because that's something I can compute as a physicist. In other words, I have a global gradient that I want to figure out, and I want to do the best I can to compute that global gradient using, for example, just information about local behavior of an edge. And so it turns out that there's a whole bunch of theories, including things like equilibrium propagation and contrastive learning, that have been developed in order to do a local approximation to a global gradient in a physical system. And so what I'm about to show you is our approximation to a contrastive learning approach, which shows in the literature. And the idea is really simple, so I'll just tell you the idea. The idea is that if you want to locally do pure shear, if you want the system to locally do pure shear, contrastive learning basically tells you you should lower the energy in the direction of that pure shear direction. Makes sense. Okay, and so this is the expression for what you should do then. You should change this energy in this way. And that leads to a slightly different local rule in the tensions that now is proportional to the length. So it still has this cosine 2 theta, but it also is proportional to the length of each edge. So just to remind you of what this is a computation of our best guess from this mechanical model of a local rule that computes the global gradient. So this is like a purely theoretical exercise in what, you know, we might think would be the best thing to do if you only had access to local information. Okay, I call this rule 3, local pure shear. And you implement this rule, and it also does convergent extension really well. Okay, good. Okay, and then the other thing that has been proposed, and there's evidence for, is like maybe this tissue is deforming because there's external forces acting on it. Like there's other things going on in the embryo. Maybe there's external shear forces that are acting on this. So the other thing that could be happening is there's nothing active going on to the tensions within this box at all. You're just applying pure shear externally through the deformation of other tissues, and it's perfectly passive. And so you can look and see what happens if you do that. And again, unsurprisingly, you get convergent extension again in some other way. Okay, so now that I've shown you all of that, maybe what you're thinking and you should be thinking is like, okay, this is a system that's been studied forever by people in the audience and there's so much known about it. What is the value to thinking about it in the way I just showed you? And it's not even as nice as some very careful experiments that have done these sorts of things previously. And so what I'd like to say is there's some really, I think, interesting things it suggests that for you to think about. Okay. The first thing is that in our system, we can see how much, you know, work is required to execute this amount of strain. And by definition, the gradient descent method, so that's this blue line, should be the best because you're going straight downhill in the task, and it is the best. But these two local rules, this L cosine theta and this cosine theta rule, are pretty close to optimal. And actually, we have a way of saying how optimal. Like, what's the difference in work required to do it optimally versus via a local rule? And that might be an interesting quantity to think about for comparing different ways that tissues could execute a given task. And I think, you know, the other questions that you can start to think about is, like, why are all of these methods so close? There's some a lot of work in the AI field talking about overparameterization and the behavior of overparameterized systems. And these, if you think about this as a computational system, it's vastly overparameterized, which means it has way more tunable degrees of freedom than features that you want to reproduce in a task. And remarkably, you know, there's these things called double descent curves for people who are, you know, experts that suggest that
systems that are over-parameterized. You might think that if you put way too many tunable degrees of freedom, you would overfit and you'd get all these fluctuations in your result, but it's not the case. You find equally good minima in AI systems, even when they're vastly over-parameterized. And that's like how ChatGPT works. It's like vastly, vastly over-parameterized, these large language models. And so this is maybe a way of thinking about biological systems, if they're doing computation, are generically vastly overparameterized, and that might help explain why features are robust to different methods of approximating this global gradient of a task. Okay, another thing that you can do is you can concretely quantify trade-offs. So one of the things we just looked at, there's many things one could look at, and we're just starting work on this, but one of the things that one of our collaborators said is, I don't think it's possible for cells to have vastly different tensions between nearby things. Like, that's hard to maintain, you know? And so you can look at the tension heterogeneity nearby of things nearby one another, and the gradient descent method has a lot more heterogeneity than either this local rule or that local rule. And so, you know, the question is maybe this is a way, well, it's definitely a way to concretely test for trade-offs. You can say, if I look at an observable, is the observable I find the one that optimizes the task of global convergent extension, or is it optimizing some other features? And you can quantify those features, and you can even start to do that quantitatively in a framework like this. Okay, another thing that you can do, and maybe this is more interesting for folks in the audience, is looking at these pictures. These are final states for some different rules. They're really different structurally. They have different shapes. They have different organization of tensions. And so, like, the one thing you can clearly do is just compare it to experiments and see which one is operating or which one is close to operating in the system of interest. And here's where there's the huge error bars, because this data is really new. But here's the data from experiments for one observable that we tend to like, which is this average cell shape parameter, which is just this perimeter to area ratio. It changes over time during germ band extension. And here is what happens to this shape parameter for different local rules. And so the interesting thing for us is this L cosine 2 theta, which is the one that we came to just by assuming that the system was doing the best it could to approximate the global gradient using local rules, matches pretty well with what you see in experiments, and the other ones don't really match very well, okay? And then you can look at more things. So this is a fraction of vertical edges, and again, this is experiments, and these are the different rules. And so, for example, you can see that external shear really doesn't work to explain that feature. And maybe some of these work better than others, but actually maybe we're missing something important in order to recapitulate that type of behavior. Although it suggests, you know, again, that this one is the best one we have so far. Okay, and so I think I'll just stop there and I'll try to summarize what I wanted to say, which is that physical learning approaches are currently being developed in all sorts of fields, in material science, in thinking about, you know, resistor, you know, making better types of computers for image analysis. They're being developed to systematically allow physical systems to learn, adapt, and optimize. So there's a lot of literature out there for folks who might be interested. And I would say that also for folks in this audience, there's a lot of open questions about what is possible in physical learning. And some folks that have expertise in biological systems might be the right people to answer some of those open questions. Using ideas from physical learning, it's possible to alter the rigidity transition of both jam spheres and vertex models. And these are two different classes of rigidity transitions by tuning individual tuning parameters, but not all of them work. And we don't know a general framework for which tunable degrees of freedom work for which tasks. In body axis elongation in Drosophila, we showed that a physical learning paradigm, it provides a concrete framework for assessing whether a system is, like, whether a given set of rules is optimally executing a task, which I've always wanted to do. You know, we think of there things being things like developmental checkpoints, like, oh, if the Drosophila elongates enough in a certain amount of time, then it can go on and do the next set of things it needs to do. But historically, I haven't had a way as a person that's been interested in mechanical modeling of these things to sort of say, how well did it do at this task that I think it's trying to do, which is elongate a certain amount. And it gives me a way to think about trade-offs, because I can say, okay, if I think it's doing that, but also there's a metabolic cost, for example, to maintaining those tensions, I can write that down and I can do a physical learning problem where I explicitly have a trade-off between those two cost functions. And I can even think about what's the ratio between those cost functions by matching it to experimental data potentially. And what we've done recently has shown that this idea generates an ensemble of ways to execute a task, different types of learning rules. I can study different types, and then I can compare it to experiments as a way of sort of high level from a systematic approach to figuring out what are the local rules that are operating in these types of systems. It's a different way of thinking about getting there. And here we focused on rules that probably evolved over evolutionary timescales. But I think a really interesting question is that these developmental systems are taking advantage of these principles to process information on developmental timescales. At the very beginning of my talk, I showed you those pictures of you cut an embryo in half and each of the two halves develops properly over developmental timescales. And so I think it would be very interesting to figure out how maybe these physical learning, in other words, thinking about doing processing, not through sort of a DNA, sort of genetic space, but just through allowing tunability to mesoscale degrees of freedom, I could execute those tasks robustly. Okay, thanks for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.